hour, he began to see what a dangerous business he'd signed up for. He believed his crew to be the best at NASA, but 4 months might not be enough for even this crew to prepare for a journey to the moon. He had no idea how the space agency would do its part to be ready by December. He could only trust that NASA had carefully crafted the mission, whatever it was, and had taken their time to work out the science. In fact, much of the plan to send Apollo 8 to the moon had been contemplated by George Lowe on the beach just 5 days earlier. As for the science, that would require some faith. To fly to the moon and land a man on its surface, the Apollo spacecraft required 3 components. Command module, the cone-shaped spacecraft where the 3 astronauts lived, worked, and conducted most of their mission. Service module, the storehouse for the craft's life support systems, its electrical power, and a large rocket engine with sufficient propellant. Lunar module, the small landing craft that shuttled 2 astronauts between the orbiting spacecraft and the lunar surface. NASA needed to test all 3 modules, both in Earth orbit and around the moon, before it could attempt a lunar landing. For months, this is how the test schedule stood. Flight, Apollo 7. Objective, test command and service modules. Location, low Earth orbit. Estimated date, September to October 1968. Flight, Apollo 8. Objective, test command, service and lunar modules. Location, low Earth orbit. Estimated date, December 1968. Flight, Apollo 9. Objective, test command, service and lunar modules. Location, high Earth orbit. Estimated date, February 1969. Flight, Apollo 10. Test command, service and lunar modules. Location, lunar orbit. Estimated date, mid-1969. Flight, Apollo 11. Objective, lunar landing. Location, lunar surface. Estimated date, late 1969. Apollo 1 had ended in a fatal fire in early 1967. Apollo 2 and Apollo 3 had been canceled after the fire. Apollo 4, Apollo 5, and Apollo 6 had already flown, each unmanned and in Earth orbit. Everything changed the morning that Lowe returned from vacation. Even before getting his coffee, he called his secretary, Judy Wyatt, to his office at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. "I want you to keep a log of people I talk to," he said, "and I want it kept under a secret cover sheet." Lowe made a list of key NASA managers and engineers and asked Wyatt to call them in. She'd worked for her boss for 2 years and knew him to be a precise and serious man. His subjects and verbs always agreed, even while he gave dictation, and he would sunbathe on the weekends with his briefcase beside him, never missing a chance to think or plan. More than anything, Lowe was efficient. He did not ask for things or take a person's time more than was necessary. On this day, he was requesting the time of several important men, and right away. He began by seeing 2 experts, one on NASA safety rules, the other on trajectories, the flight path a rocket would take to its destination. Then he called in a legend. Christopher Columbus Kraft was already a name known to America when he walked into Lowe's office that morning. An aeronautical engineer by training, Kraft had begun his career in 1944 at age 20 at NACA, the precursor agency to NASA. Small, fit, and serious, with slicked back black hair graying at the temples, Kraft had masterminded the concept of mission control, a central location where nearly all aspects of a spaceflight were managed and supported. By 1965, he'd appeared on the cover of Time magazine. In the accompanying article, he compared his role as flight director to that of a symphony conductor. "The conductor can't play all the instruments. He may not even be able to play any one of them," Kraft said. "But he knows when the first violin should be playing, and he knows when the trumpet should be loud or soft, and when the drummer should be drumming. He mixes all this up and out comes music. That's what we do here. The magazine noted that Kraft took an almost angry pride in his work, an assessment with which many at NASA agreed. Now he was the director of flight operations for NASA, responsible for the overall planning, training, and execution of manned spaceflight. Whenever Lowe had a problem, he went to Kraft. Almost always that problem got solved. The men shook hands, then Lowe put a question to Kraft. Could Apollo 8 fly to the moon in December? Kraft could have spent the day listing all the reasons why that was impossible. Instead, he just asked, "How?" "By leaving the lunar module behind," Lowe said. The command and service modules, Lowe reminded Kraft, were in fine shape. Technically, there was no reason those two components couldn't fly without the troubled lunar module, leapfrog the missions of the next two Apollo flights, and go directly to the moon. The idea seemed heresy to Kraft. No man had ever flown more than 853 miles above Earth's surface. Now, Lowe was proposing to send three astronauts a quarter of a million miles away, and to do it half a year sooner than anyone at NASA had planned. As if that weren't enough, Lowe was proposing to skip not one, but two preparatory Apollo flights, violating one of NASA's foundational philosophies, that missions be incremental to assure mastery and success. And yet, Kraft saw elegance, even genius, in the plan. Lowe wasn't proposing to land Apollo 8 on the moon, just to fly around it, so no lunar module was necessary. By going in December, NASA could prove many of the systems and procedures and much of the equipment and technology required for a lunar landing. It could gain valuable deep space experience and avoid the months of downtime that would come from delaying Apollo 8 until the lunar module was ready. That would put the agency back on track to make Kennedy's deadline. And there was another benefit. A December launch gave America a chance to beat the Soviets to the moon. Still, the logistical challenges seemed insurmountable to Kraft. Mission control would need to be readied, trajectories and navigation calculated, an entire deep space communication network finished, an astronaut crew quickly trained, the flight control team brought up to speed and made confident, new software written, instrumentation calibrated. Even if Apollo 8 somehow flew to the moon and back, NASA would not, as matters presently stood, be able to retrieve the crew, as the agency had yet to schedule an operation for recovering the astronauts when their capsule splashed down in the middle of the ocean. Engineers hadn't even run a trajectory analysis to account for the phases of the moon in December, or lunar lighting at that time of year, or the position of the moon relative to Earth during such a flight. Even if NASA could manage all that, the risks of undertaking a lunar mission in December were enormous. Kraft could hardly scribble a list of them fast enough on his steno pad, but two stood out above the rest. First, the Saturn V rocket, the only one powerful enough to reach the moon, had never flown with men aboard. It had been tested only twice, the second time in April, when it had suffered near catastrophic problems. If Apollo 8 was to go to the moon in December, there wouldn't be time to test the rocket again. The next time the Saturn V rocket flew, it would be with the crew of Apollo 8 aboard. Second, the lunar module also served as a backup engine, a lifeboat of sorts. Going without it meant that if Apollo 8's single engine failed or malfunctioned at the moon, the crew could smash into the lunar surface, or be stranded in lunar orbit, or fly off toward the sun. And yet Kraft couldn't bring himself to say no. He asked for a day to study the problem, then met with several experts. He returned to Lowe's office the next morning with startling news. Kraft thought Apollo 8 should do more than just go to the moon in December. He thought Apollo 8 should orbit the moon. That nearly knocked Low from his chair. A lunar flyby, as Low had proposed and the Soviets planned, required only that a spacecraft be pointed at the moon. If aimed precisely, it would be pulled in by the moon's gravity, whipped around its far side, and slingshotted back toward Earth, all without relying on the complex engine burns and calculations that were required to enter and exit a lunar orbit. That made things simpler by an order of magnitude, because it put gravity in charge, not engineers and rockets. In essence, Low had wanted Apollo 8 to fly a classic figure eight from the Earth around the moon and back again. Engineers had worked on this so-called free return trajectory for years, and NASA was certain it was sound. Now, Kraft was suggesting Apollo 8 do something much more difficult. Entering and exiting lunar orbit, whereby the spacecraft would slow itself enough to become captured by the moon's gravity, then speed up again to leave, required intervention. Engines had to be fired, altitudes changed, speeds modified, navigation altered, and countless other adjustments made. All of it required complex calculations, software, training, and planning far beyond what was required for a free return flight, and little of which NASA had in its current arsenal. Yet the benefits of orbiting the moon could be immense. Putting Apollo 8 into lunar orbit would provide NASA with all kinds of experience it needed for the upcoming landing mission. Everything from deep space maneuvers to rocket firings to navigation to communications to propellant consumption to life support systems could be tested under the same conditions NASA would face when landing men on the moon. New mission rules and procedures could be put through their paces, simulations appraised, training revised. And once the spacecraft arrived, the crew of Apollo 8 could photograph the moon from up close, scouting potential landing sites for the lucky successors, who would be the first to step onto its surface. Low saw the beauty in Kraft's upgrade to his plan. The two men hurried to the offices of other top managers at NASA's Houston buildings, who quickly agreed that sending Apollo 8 to the moon in December might be the boldest and riskiest and most important mission NASA ever attempted. Now they needed to know whether their NASA counterparts in Washington, D.C., at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, and at the Launch Control Center at Cape Kennedy in Florida, would agree. On that very same morning, Friday, August 9th, Low, Kraft, and other top brass in Houston scheduled a meeting with leaders from all the primary NASA centers. Ordinarily, it would have taken a week or more to get all these men together. On this day, they were given until 2:30 p.m. to pack a sandwich, find an airplane, and get to Huntsville, where the meeting would take place. Everyone arrived on time. Gathered around a conference table, the 12 men in the room represented a murderer's row of NASA brass. Among them was Wernher von Braun, the world's most renowned rocket designer and the director of the Marshall Space Flight Center. Von Braun had been a member of the Nazi Party and was instrumental in developing rockets, including the infamous V-2 that Hitler launched against targets in Europe. Von Braun surrendered to the Americans in 1945 and went to work for the United States Army, designing rockets. But it was in 1960 that he was charged with one of the most important tasks in the history of space exploration, developing the Saturn super booster that would take men to the moon. He became the chief architect of the Saturn V, the most powerful machine ever built, and the only vehicle in the world capable of making George Low's vision for Apollo 8 come true. Notably absent from this meeting was NASA's administrator and top boss, James E. Webb, who was attending a conference in Vienna, Austria. Given the sacrilege that was about to be discussed, it seemed just as well that Webb was thousands of miles away. Low and others from Houston made their pitch to send Apollo 8 into lunar orbit on a flight scheduled for December. Spirited discussions broke out, ricocheting from man to man, about the benefits and dangers of flying such an audacious mission, and about how to solve all its unsolvable problems. Finally, it came time to take a poll of the men in the room. The groups from Houston, Washington, and Cape Kennedy agreed. Apollo 8 would be the most difficult and dangerous mission NASA had ever flown. But with unprecedented effort and a good dose of luck, it might be done. It was worth the risk, these men thought, to keep Apollo on track. And it escaped the notice of no one that there would be a history-changing bonus to flying in December. If Apollo 8 made the lunar journey, America might beat the Soviet Union to the moon. That left the group from Huntsville and the matter of the rocket. Neither von Braun nor anyone else in the meeting needed to be reminded of the Saturn V's recent problems. And yet the mission was impossible unless the rocket could be made ready. The moon hung on von Braun's verdict. He thought for a moment, then spoke. In terms of distance traveled, von Braun said, the Saturn V did not know or care how far the spacecraft went. Like all thoroughbreds, it was built to be pushed to the limit, and in this case, the limit was the moon. And so he did have a verdict.
You don't give us much time, he said, but it's a great idea. We just have to see if we can get everything together. But we will try.
The matter settled. The group agreed to adjourn, but not before making a pact. First, they would take a few days to study the myriad risks and challenges of changing Apollo 8's mission, smoking out any showstoppers, problems that could not be solved in time for a December lunar orbit mission. Any of those and the new plan for Apollo 8 would be off. Second, they would not breathe a word of this to anyone. It would be hard enough to convince Webb, not to mention Congress and the President, that rushing to the moon was a good or even a sane idea. If word leaked before they ruled out any seemingly insurmountable roadblocks, Washington was sure to bring down the hammer on the plan before it got started. They would talk again in 5 days. If all looked good then, they would go to NASA's boss for the go-ahead. And that's how things stood a day later, when Slayton got down to choosing a crew. He might have given the new mission to Jim McDivitt, who was currently assigned to command Apollo 8. But McDivitt's crew had more experience with the lunar module than did Borman's. So Slayton decided to keep McDivitt ready for when the troubled module was finally flight-worthy. He pitched Borman on the new plan for Apollo 8 the next day. Now, Borman flew back to tell his crew of their new mission, one that hadn't even been officially approved. He'd answered for them in Slayton's office, never imagining they might say no. Yet, this was the most dangerous mission NASA had ever contemplated. Borman assumed they'd be as eager as he was to take a sudden shot at the moon, but there was every chance he was wrong. Sometimes Borman used the T-38 to do aerobatics, looping and rolling to help clear the cobwebs after a hard day's work. This time, he flew level and fast, back to his crewmates in California, in the straightest line a test pilot ever flew. Chapter 4. Are you out of your mind? Back at the assembly plant in California, later in the day on August 10th, Borman found his two partners and pulled them aside. Jim Lovell had joined NASA along with Borman in 1962 as part of the New Nine, the second group of astronauts enlisted by the agency. Like Borman, he was 40 years old and a test pilot, but the similarities seemed to end there. Since boyhood, Lovell had been thrilled by rockets and the idea of space travel. He'd gone so far as to attempt to build a liquid oxygen-powered booster while in high school, and he remained dazzled by the idea of exploring the cosmos. He was also, by most everyone's account, as warm and friendly a guy as one could meet. Bill Anders was just 34, 5.5 years younger than his two crewmates. He'd come up through the ranks as a fighter pilot, not a test pilot. That alone generated contempt from some of the older astronauts, most of whom were test pilots and didn't fully see the daring in climbing into already proven machines. Perhaps even worse for Anders, he was an intellectual among men more immediate and visceral. A holder of an advanced degree in nuclear engineering, and who the hell needed that on the way to the moon? Still, when people saw him fly, they knew they were watching something special. And while it was true he'd flown airplanes already certified by the likes of his colleagues, others could see that he could turn those birds around and shoot most anyone's ass out of the sky. Borman gathered his crew outside the test bay where they'd been working on the command module. "Things have changed," Borman said. "If everything goes right with Apollo 7, they want to send Apollo 8 to the moon by the end of the year. And we are now Apollo 8. It took a few moments for Lovell and Anders to process what they were hearing. "The moon? By December? Us?" And there was more, Borman said. Apollo 8 would go without a lunar module, and it would orbit the moon. Lovell could not fight back his smile. "Oh man, this is great," he thought. "This is what I've been dreaming about." He could see the genius in the plan right away, and the personal benefits weren't lost on him either. A lunar mission would spare him another Earth orbital flight, two of which he'd made already as part of the Gemini program. Best of all, it positioned him to do what he loved most, explore and pioneer. And there seemed no better way to do it than by becoming the first man ever to fly to the moon. Anders saw it differently. This new mission would kneecap his chances for landing on the moon. He'd trained as a lunar module pilot. Unless he messed that up, it meant he would walk on the moon one day. But this new mission had no lunar module, so his duties would shift to the command module, and guys who flew command modules didn't land on the moon. 5 minutes ago, Anders would have put his chances of walking on the lunar surface at 80%. Now, they'd slipped to between slim and none. It was a Saturday, and the end of the work week for all of them. The men packed away their gear and climbed into their T-38s, Borman and Lovell in one, Anders by himself in another, and took off into the clouds. In the back seat of Borman's plane, Lovell began sketching an image on his knee pad. A big Earth in the foreground, a smaller moon in the background, with a figure eight drawn around the two bodies. It formed both the mission trajectory and its designated number, 8. What a natural thing for Apollo 8, he thought, and he knew this would be a fine insignia for the patch the crew would wear on their way, on mankind's way, to the moon. It was just a few minutes' drive from Ellington Air Force Base to the astronauts' homes in the suburbs. Each man would have preferred more than the usual one day per week at home with his family, but the rigors of training required subordinating family, and everything else, to the mission at hand. In fact, the men and their wives felt lucky. Borman, Lovell, and Anders had served in the military and knew what it was like to be away from home for long stretches. And each of them had friends fighting thousands of miles away in Vietnam, and they gladly would have served there or anywhere else the country needed them to fight. The couples had all become expert at making the most of 24 hours of family time every week. None of the men had called home to discuss the proposed new mission with his wife. It hadn't even crossed their minds. It wasn't that they didn't respect their wives' opinions. It wasn't even that they were living in a male-dominated culture. These were military men, and even though NASA had been set up as a civilian organization, it was clear to all astronauts and to their families that NASA assignments were orders. Borman greeted his wife with a kiss and told her about the new mission. As always, Susan smiled and clasped his hand. Inside, she was dying. "The moon?" she thought, trying to absorb what he was telling her. It was August. NASA hadn't even tested the command module yet. December, that was, what, 4 months away? Usually crews trained for a year or more. To the moon? She told Frank how proud she was, how important the mission sounded, and that there was no better man for the job. Then she turned and went into another room, where she wished she could kick down a door. "They're rushing it," she thought. "They're leapfrogging. They're too anxious to get it going." Over the course of Frank's career, she'd closed her eyes and hoped for the best, but she could see that this mission was different, that she needed to stop living in a cocoon and pretending her husband would always be home for Sunday dinner, because this time, Frank wouldn't just be running another test flight. This time, he would be leaving the world. As always, Frank thanked God for Susan. She always supported him, never made him worry about her or their two teenage boys. He had no inkling of what was going on inside her or how badly she'd been hurting since Apollo 1 had taken Ed White, the husband of her close friend Pat White. Susan knew Frank had enough pressure at work, and she considered it her mission to make home a place where he never worried. Borman told the news to his two sons, Fred and Edwin. To the boys, the moon sounded pretty cool. Borman would have showed them where he was going, if only he'd owned a lunar map. At his home, Anders shared the news with his wife, Valerie. Even as he spoke, she thought, this is a big and scary change. But she also had been steeling herself to danger since she was a little girl. Her father had been a motorcycle-riding California highway patrolman, and she believed beating the Soviets to be a worthy goal. Bill had always been straight with Valerie, and it would do no good to sugarcoat things now. He laid out his thinking on the risks. He thought there was a one-third chance of a successful mission, a one-third chance of a failed mission that managed to make it back home, and a one-third chance the crew wouldn't return at all. He hated to worry her, but he knew if she sensed he was bullshitting, she just would have worried more. Valerie trusted that these odds were accurate, though they were not numbers any young mother of five liked to hear. She thought about other military wives, some of whom had husbands missing in action, and she remembered that her husband, like most astronauts, would be fighting in Vietnam, eagerly, if he weren't training to fly to the moon. She kissed Bill and told him she believed in NASA, in the mission, and in him. On Lovell's arrival home, his wife, Marilyn, made a happy announcement. She'd scored several bargains on clothes for the family's upcoming Christmas vacation in Acapulco. It was hard for her to believe it was happening. She couldn't remember if they'd even attempted a vacation since he'd joined NASA 6 years earlier. Jim smiled as Marilyn held up her brightly colored beach buys, but she could see his mind wasn't on Mexico. "Are you all right?" she asked. He motioned her into his study. "I can't go on vacation," he said. "I can't believe it," Marilyn replied. "I've already made all these plans for Acapulco. I'm going somewhere else. Somewhere special." "Where are you going?" Jim grinned. "Would you believe the moon?" Looking into Jim's eyes, Marilyn still saw him as the boy she'd met in high school, who talked about stars and planets, and as the first-year Naval Academy midshipman who'd asked her to type up his term paper that predicted men would someday ride rockets into space. She knew that this was what her husband had been seeking all his life. Lovell called his four children, ages 2 through 15, into the study and told them the news. He did own a lunar map, and he laid it out on his desk to show his kids where America wanted him to go. Now that Lowe and other top NASA managers had decided to shoot for the moon, they needed to pick the best day to go. A primary objective was to replicate a landing mission to the fullest extent possible in order to provide the agency with relevant experience for when it ran the real thing. That meant, among other things, figuring out the optimal alignment between Earth and Moon so that the flight required no more propellant than necessary, and so that there would be excellent lunar lighting to scout potential landing sites. Only a few days per month lined up like that, so NASA had to choose well. Management had access over the weekend to the agency's 7 giant mainframe computers, which calculated 4 possible launch windows. Optimal liftoff would be December 20th or 21st, with a splashdown 6 days later in the Pacific Ocean. That gave Apollo 8 its best look at the moon, and time to make several orbits, each of which would last about 2 hours. It also allowed for an early morning countdown at Cape Kennedy, which would give NASA plenty of daylight to rescue the crew if something went wrong during launch. That all sounded fine to Kraft until he realized what that meant. Apollo 8 would be in orbit around the moon on Christmas. He knew NASA would be accused of selecting the date for effect, but all he could do then would be to tell the truth. The agency hadn't chosen Christmas. Nature had. For the next several days, many of NASA's top managers and engineers stepped up their already intense schedule and worked around the clock to study the viability of Lowe's plan, looking for any showstoppers and keeping it a secret from the wider organization. A few days later, they were convinced. It would take a near miracle, but every problem could be solved. Every challenge could be met. Now, it was time to go to NASA's top boss, James E. Webb, for permission. Some at NASA doubted that Webb would even listen. The Apollo 1 fire had nearly put him and the agency out of business, and it seemed unlikely he'd risk another tragedy. But they had to make their pitch now if the agency was to have any hope of sending Apollo 8 to the moon by year's end. The job of seeking official permission fell to Webb's deputy, Thomas Paine, a young, forward-thinking engineer, and to Air Force General Samuel Phillips, director of the Apollo Manned Lunar Landing Program. Phillips at first wanted to do it in person, but then thought better of it. A sudden trip to Vienna by high-ranking officials of the American space program might tip off the Soviets that NASA was planning something big. The better idea was to use a secure telephone line and hope for the best. Paine and Phillips reached Webb at the American Embassy in Vienna. They had reason to hope Webb would see the genius of the new plan. Since Kennedy's speech in 1961, Webb had been a champion for Apollo, protecting and advancing the program with Congress, playing by street rules when necessary. So, the men laid out their vision for Apollo 8. "Are you out of your mind?" Webb yelled. He began to count off the risks of sending Apollo 8 to the moon in December, only to grow more indignant with each one, and his list didn't seem to end. "You're putting the agency and the whole program at risk," Webb finally said. And it was hard to argue with any of it. Three astronauts had died a horrific death on the launch pad less than 2 years earlier. Congress would not abide another three dead, especially if it occurred because NASA had hurried. And Webb added a final point. If those three men are stranded out there and die in lunar orbit, no one, lovers, poets, no one, will ever look at the moon the same way again. No one had considered that, but it was true of Christmas, too. Borman, Lovell, and Anders would be in lunar orbit on December 25th. If they died then, Christmas would never be the same in America, or maybe in all the world. Every year, it would be a tragic reminder of a mission gone horribly wrong. Webb had little to gain by signing his name to such a risky plan, and though he hadn't announced it, he planned to resign in a few months, ending his 7-year tenure at NASA. No sense in sticking his neck out for a crazy mission he wouldn't even be around to oversee. And yet, even as he continued screaming into his telephone, he did not say no. Instead, he said he'd think about it. And he promised to get back to the men the next day. As NASA awaited Webb's verdict on Apollo 8, Soviet cosmonauts trained for their own December lunar mission. It was a treacherous business, and they were taking risks that were normally forbidden. But with the moon in the balance, these were not normal times. A day later, Webb found a secure phone line in Vienna and called his men in Washington. He still thought the new plan for Apollo 8 was saturated with risk and danger, and that it could ruin NASA. but he could not deny its potential. He gave Payne and Phillips the go-ahead to prepare for a December lunar launch, but warned that he would not sign off on the plan unless and until Apollo 7 orbited Earth and completed its mission objectives in the fall. That was all the green light these men needed. Even as they hung up, they were dialing top NASA brass. The big guy had spoken. 8 was go for the moon. Now NASA needed a flight plan. Ordinarily, that took months to devise, but time was suddenly a luxury of a bygone era. Early in the afternoon on August 18th, Borman met with Kraft and some of NASA's top designers, planners, and engineers in Houston. Everyone had come to hammer out a blueprint for Apollo 8's flight to the moon. No one intended to leave until it was done. Borman looked around the office. To him, this was the ideal setup. No committees, no memos, no suits from Washington, just top-notch guys led by Kraft, cigar in mouth and as tough under pressure as a fighter pilot, who would make the final decisions on everything. "Okay, so we're going to the moon in December," Kraft said. "Now let's figure out how we might do that." Everyone started with the same basic questions. How long should the journey last? How many orbits should we make around the moon? How high above the lunar surface should we fly? What do we most want to accomplish? What should the crew be doing? When do we want to come home? The planners took on the subject of lunar orbits first, and their desire was simple. They wanted the maximum number the mission could sustain. Borman's reply was equally simple. Forget it. The meeting was 5 minutes old, and already the players were stuck. Borman understood their position. Every orbit gave NASA more opportunity to gain experience for a future lunar landing. But they had to understand his first priority, which was the safety of his crew. He, Lovell, and Anders would be flying an unproven spacecraft on a mission riskier than any NASA had ever attempted. To him, each additional orbit was another chance for something to go wrong. As far as Borman was concerned, flying once around the moon would be a historic accomplishment, and more than enough to beat out the Russians. Borman's position didn't please Kraft's men, who thought it wasteful to take all the risk of flying to the moon, only to leave early once they got there. Kraft jumped in to calm the planners down. "What's the absolute minimum you can take?" he asked them. The men thought about it and came back with an answer. 12. Since each orbit would last about 2 hours, that gave the crew 24 hours around the moon. 10 is better, Borman shot back. But the men shook their heads. If Apollo 8 flew only 10 orbits, it would splash down in the Pacific Ocean before dawn. That meant if the parachutes malfunctioned, no one could see what was happening. "What the hell does that matter?" Borman said. "If the chute works, great. If it doesn't, we're all dead, and it won't make any difference if anyone can see us." No one could argue with that. Kraft asked if his men could accept 10 orbits. They nodded. Kraft liked it. 10 was a rational, empirical number, and like that, it was 10 orbits. The question then became, at what altitude to orbit? Kraft and his men wanted Apollo 8 to fly just 69 miles above the lunar surface, the same altitude at which the command and service modules would operate during a future landing mission. That required almost unimaginable precision, equivalent in scale to throwing a dart at a peach from a distance of 28 feet and grazing the very top of the fuzz without touching the fruit's skin. If that weren't daunting enough, the moon would be barreling through space at nearly 2,300 miles per hour. Toss a peach in the air at 28 feet and now hit the top of the fuzz with a dart. That's what these trajectory experts were proposing to do, and soon, everyone agreed to do it. As the men continued to talk, the details of the flight took shape. Launch would occur in early morning from the Kennedy Space Center on December 21st, when the new moon would be just a sliver in the sky. Borman and crew would orbit Earth for a short time to check out the health of the rocket and spacecraft. If all looked good, they would attempt to relight the Saturn V's third stage engine. No sure thing, as it had failed on the test flight in April. If it did work, the engine would push Apollo 8 to a speed of 24,200 miles per hour, enough to break free of Earth's gravitational pull. To date, no human had ventured more than 853 miles away from Mother Earth. Borman, Lovell, and Anders would blast past that in a few minutes. Even then, they would still have to cover nearly 240,000 miles to reach the moon, about 58 times the distance Columbus had sailed to find his own new world. The Earth-Moon crossing would last about 66 hours. The astronauts would spend much of that time doing navigation sightings, making live television broadcasts, and checking systems. The spacecraft would fly on a precise round-trip pathway, aimed close enough to the moon's surface to ensure that if anything went wrong along the way, the moon itself would make the rescue, catching the ship with its gravity and slingshotting it back to Earth, all courtesy of the laws of physics, with no man-made propulsion required. As Apollo 8 neared its target, the moon would be moving at more than 2,000 miles per hour, with the spacecraft rapidly accelerating, both approaching nearly the same spot in space. If NASA's figures were accurate, the ship would slide just ahead of the moon's leading hemisphere, then use lunar gravity to curl behind the lunar far side. Once the spacecraft went behind the moon, all communication with mission control would be blocked. At that point, if all looked good, Borman would fire the Service Propulsion System, or SPS, engine, which would slow the ship enough to be captured by the moon's gravity and enter lunar orbit. There was no backup to the SPS. If it didn't fire, Apollo 8 would whip around the moon and return to Earth. The real problem would come if the engine fired incorrectly, too short or too weak, and the spacecraft would fly off into eternal space. Too long or too strong, and it would crash into the moon in less than an hour. If it all worked, however, Apollo 8 would enter an irregular orbit about 69 miles above the lunar surface on the far side and about 200 miles over the near side. For two revolutions, about 4 hours, the crew would prepare their cameras and observe landmarks. Then they would get ready to fire the SPS engine again, this time to circularize their orbit at a constant 69 miles above the lunar surface. It would then be Christmas Eve morning back in America. Once in a circular orbit, the crew would do the bulk of its work. For 8 revolutions over the next 16 hours, they would scout candidate landing sites for future missions, take photographs, analyze lighting conditions, and study the effects of gravitational anomalies on the spacecraft's orbit. All the while, mission control would be tracking the spacecraft by radio and communicating with the astronauts, except when Apollo 8 was over the far side of the moon. And there would be 2 more television broadcasts. As Borman did the math, he could see that these would come on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. During the final 2 revolutions, the astronauts would get ready to fire the SPS engine again, this time to gain enough speed to get the spacecraft out of lunar orbit and on its way back to Earth. As before, the firing would be done over the far side of the moon, out of contact with Houston and the rest of the world. It was another critical maneuver. If it misfired, the ship could crash into the moon or fly off into the void. If it failed to fire, Apollo 8 would become a possession of the moon. Forever. But if all went according to plan, the spacecraft would escape lunar orbit and begin its 57-hour journey home. In the flight's last minutes, the service module containing the engine would be jettisoned, leaving the astronauts in the cone-shaped command module they would ride the rest of the way to Earth. A short time later, the capsule would begin re-entry into Earth's atmosphere at near 25,000 miles per hour. No human had ever attempted such a thing, and it had to be virtually perfect, or Borman and his crew wouldn't survive. Angle of attack was everything. Apollo 8 needed to enter a corridor that spanned just 2 degrees. That was equivalent to finding exactly the right ridge on a coin that had 180 ridges grooved into it. By comparison, a United States quarter dollar has 119 ridges. If the spacecraft came in too shallow, it would skip off the atmosphere like a stone on water, going into a large elliptical trajectory around Earth without enough oxygen or electricity on board to get back for another attempt at re-entry. If it came in too steeply, it would grind so hard against the atmosphere that the resulting heat and deceleration would burn up and tear apart the capsule. But if it came in just right, the atmosphere would slow the capsule down enough to allow it to survive re-entry into the atmosphere and plunge toward Earth. 2 degrees. Anything on either side of that, and the crew was dead. If Apollo 8 survived re-entry, and if its heat shield succeeded in preventing its incineration in temperatures that would reach 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, half that of the surface of the sun, the triple canopy of parachutes would deploy, and the capsule would splash down in the Pacific Ocean about 45 minutes before first light. The astronauts would stay inside until a Navy recovery crew reached them. By that time, Apollo 8's historic voyage would have ended, after a little more than 6 days. Borman looked at the other men in the room. Each wore the same expression. "We know this is impossible, but we still think it can work." He appreciated their commitment and expertise, but he thought they'd planned too much for the crew to do. Every hour seemed loaded with tasks, duties, obligations, checks. "Forget the TV cameras," Borman said. "It's a distraction." "No way," Kraft said. "This is history, Frank. This belongs to the American people." "We're here to do a job," Borman said. "That's part of the job," Kraft answered. Borman saw no yielding in Kraft's eyes. The cameras would stay. Borman still objected that the work plan was too crowded, and Kraft didn't deny it. There was a lot to do, maybe too much. But 6 days on a moonshot was an eye blink, given the risks and expenditures required to get there. So they damn well had to get the most out of it. Anything less, and none of them would be doing his job. That made sense to Borman. And with that, the plan was complete. The men checked their watches. It was 5 p.m. In just 4 hours, they designed a mission that would send the first human beings away from their home planet, have them orbit the moon, then return home. In a year that was shaping up to be among the most fractious in the nation's history, in which its citizens were rippling with anger and its institutions were no longer trusted, something sublime had occurred in this office. Shaking hands, Kraft and Borman had the same thought. This was a great afternoon. This was America at her best. The two men left the building together. As Borman walked past the other astronauts' Corvettes and climbed into his 1955 Ford pickup, Kraft could only admire him. Even during this technical meeting, Borman had been true to form, direct, principled, and bullshit-free. Unwilling to look past minor details or compromise around edges. To many, including Kraft, he seemed the ideal astronaut to command the riskiest flight NASA might ever undertake. To those who knew him best, it seemed Borman had arrived at a crossroads, not just in his career, but in his life.
Chapter 5. Frank Borman. Frank Frederick Borman first left Earth at age 5 in 1933, when his father took him on a trip from their home in Gary, Indiana, to an airfield in Ohio. There, a barnstorming pilot wedged father and son into the front seat of a Waco biplane and flew them over the countryside. 5-year-old Frank could hardly process the freedom of it all. The open cockpit, the wind in his face, nothing between him and the rest of the world as the machine growled and swooped through an endless sky. The pilot asked for $5 when the airplane finally settled back on Earth. A fortune during the Great Depression, and the greatest bargain Frank could imagine. Not long after, Frank's family moved to Tucson, Arizona. His father, Edwin Borman, leased a mobile service station and tried to make a go of it. The Bormans didn't have much, just a modest two-bedroom home and a 1929 Dodge with creaky wooden spokes. As the Depression moved into the 1930s, Edwin's business suffered, and he lost his gas station lease. It was then that Frank saw his dad live by the mantra he'd been preaching forever. Do not quit. Stay in there and pitch. Edwin took a job changing tires at another garage, then found work driving a laundry truck. Frank's mother opened their house to boarders to make extra money. At school, Frank's teachers observed him to be bossy and headstrong, a report that didn't surprise his parents. Since the day Frank could walk, he had moved in straight lines and with shoulders pinned forward, a kid compelled to arrive. Not everyone knew where Frank was going, not even his mom and dad sometimes, but it seemed to them a mistake to label the boy rude or abrupt just for pushing past people and things that slowed him down. They'd always told Frank he could be the best at whatever he chose if he did things the right way, with excellence and integrity, no shortcuts. Edwin and Frank often sat together at their living room card table building model airplanes, some powered by rubber bands, others by tiny, temperamental gas engines that screamed like banshees. Frank learned to take responsibility for his creations. Edwin never stepped in and finished the job for Frank, no matter how many times the engines wouldn't fire, even during model airplane competitions, even while judges were waiting. He just let Frank keep working, keep adjusting, until the Borman plane flew better and farther than all the rest. By the late 1930s, many kids across America had become fascinated by the idea of space travel. Scientists were developing rocket technologies, and the future that these machines promised exploded in color in popular science and adventure magazines, comic strips, and films. Frank couldn't have cared less. Science fiction bored him. If his friends went to see movies about spaceships, he stayed home and built airplanes, the kind of machines that flew for real. Frank entered high school in 1942. In the midst of World War II. Schoolwork came easily to him, which left him time for deeper pleasures. One day, he wandered over to nearby Gilpin Airport and told the manager he wanted to fly. The man had no problem with Frank's age, 15, but warned that lessons cost $9 an hour. Frank knew his parents couldn't afford that, but he did some quick mental math. By combining the salaries from his three current jobs, bag boy at Safeway, gas station jockey, and sweeper at Steinfeld's department store, he could put himself into the air. He signed up and was taken to a hangar where he met his instructor, who was about 30 years old, had trained very few students, and was dressed not like a pilot, but in Levi's and a white t-shirt, which was unusual at the time for a woman. In the 1940s, only about 100 women worked as flight instructors in the United States. Bobby Kroll was one of them. Frank hardly noticed her gender, she hardly noticed his age, and at once they were together in the cockpit. Miss Bobby was an ideal teacher. She would not yell or panic, and she remained calm when Frank banked too hard or struggled to come out of a stall. After just 8 hours of dual instruction, she turned Frank loose to solo. For the next 3 years, Frank continued taking flying lessons, making good grades, and playing quarterback on his high school football team. But his best night of high school came during senior year at a local dance in Tucson, when he spent the evening moonstruck by a golden-haired sophomore named Susan Bugby. She'd been voted the most beautiful girl in her class, and Frank, a longtime believer in democracy, thought the voters had gotten it right.
He was aching to ask her out. But this young man, who stared down thunderstorms and small airplanes, couldn't stomach the idea of rejection. Instead, he came up with a plan. A friend of Frank's would call Susan on the phone. Pretending to be Frank, he would ask her for a date. That way, if she said no, Frank wouldn't hear it. Susan said yes. Frank wished he'd heard it. The two began dating, and right away, Frank sensed he'd met his soulmate. Susan was bright and quick-witted, warm and fun, and loyal to her friends. Sometimes she wrote Susan Bugaboo instead of Bugbee in her notebooks. She had a mischievous gleam in her eye, the same as when she'd been in elementary school and pulled the fire alarm during a rainstorm as a prank. The nuns were not happy. Susan's father loved it and smoothed things over with the sisters. Susan's parents were both college graduates, rare in those days. Her mother was Tucson's first female dental hygienist, her father a surgeon who'd moved to Arizona after losing a lung to tuberculosis. Susan had been very close to her father, who took her on house calls and had her join him on his volunteer work to help the underprivileged. They often went on adventures together. On his days off, he would drive her outside the Tucson city limits to the ends of dusty roads, where they would capture tortoises together. She'd keep them as pets for a while, then release them. And Dr. Bugbee would buy his daughter turquoise jewelry from Native Americans who sold their wares from the backs of old pickup trucks. Susan was never as close to her mother, who seemed to resent her for all the attention people paid to her. One day, when Susan was 13, her father had an asthma attack. His oxygen bottle was empty, so Susan's mother told her to run to Johnson's drugstore and get a new one. Susan got the pharmacist to drive her home to save time and in case he could help. But by the time she returned, her father lay dead on the floor. "You're late," Susan's mother said. "You killed your father." The words devastated Susan. On the spot, she knew she'd never forget them. But something about that incident steeled Susan's spine. From the day Frank began dating her, he sensed an undergirding of strength in Susan. "This girl," he thought, "can handle anything." As high school drew to a close, Frank needed to decide on a future. He wanted to be a fighter pilot, a perfect way to combine flying and defense of his country. World War II had ended nearly a year earlier, but already tensions were building with the Soviet Union. No less an expert in looming tyranny than Winston Churchill now warned that an iron curtain had descended across Europe. Frank believed him. After scoring high on admissions exams, Frank enrolled at the United States Military Academy at West Point in the fall of 1946. Cadet Borman was all baby face and golden hair compared to his classmates. Many had already attended college, and at least half were veterans of World War II. In early fall, Borman tried out for the plebe first-year football team. He'd been a star high school quarterback, but at this level, he didn't have the necessary arm strength. He joined anyway, as the varsity team's assistant manager, in charge of gathering dirty socks and sweaty jock straps. It was thrilling for Borman, who got to observe head coach Earl Blake's legendary intensity, and to watch one of the young assistant coaches, Vince Lombardi, develop his own military coaching style. Borman fell in love with West Point. The rules, the order, the discipline. It all seemed designed to tune out distraction and allow a man to get on with what really mattered. As a kid, he'd already been different from his peers. He went after the things that were important to him, as if he were on a mission. At West Point, nothing mattered but the mission. He pledged himself to the academy's motto, duty, honor, country. It seemed to Borman that a person who believed in anything less wouldn't get where he needed to go. All the while, Borman and Susan continued dating, if only by U.S. mail. She was still in Tucson, and they were separated by more than 2,000 miles. West Point did not allow furloughs for plebes, even for holidays. Fearing he'd receive a breakup letter from Susan, Borman struck first. sending a letter to Susan saying they needed to cool their relationship. It only made sense in light of their distance, his commitment to West Point, and the focus he'd need to make his new dream of becoming an Air Force general.